My name's Jay Plumback, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. Well, not right here, but I'm glad to be down here at Edisto Island. Oh, don't misunderstand me, Mary Kay. I really am. I'm glad to be here. I'm honored to be a part of anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank you for inviting me. I thank you and the committee for having invited me and for all the amenities you've extended. And Ted, he's called a number of times. He had to send two maps because I lost the first one. How many maps do I need to get 100 miles or 150 miles? I live in Myrtle Beach. He gave it to me in Augusta. I managed to get here anyhow enough, and I've had a good, good weekend. They said this is supposed to be a spiritual message, and I'm sorry, I don't know how spiritual it'll be because I stepped in a wad of dog shit just before I walked in. And I've been trying to scrape my shoes while I'm sitting in that chair. Ken, you probably could have handled this a whole lot better. When I said I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic, that's the whole package. You know, for a lot of years, I didn't know what I was, and I didn't like who I was. Through good sponsorship, following some simple directions, and because of a loving God, so I found through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since March the 8th, 1974, and I will never be able to express to you how grateful I am for that. And I have fun in AA. I have a lot of fun. If I didn't have a lot of fun getting here, I thought it was fun. But it wasn't fun. You know, I tell people, I said, I'm having fun. And I wound up getting in jail. And I said, I'm having fun. Well, I mean, that's the trouble with fun. It starts off as fun, winds up in jail. You know, I didn't mean it that way. But no matter what was going on, I didn't want it to be bad. I wanted it to be fun because I remembered fun. And I know everybody that's an alcoholic in my nature has had fun. And the thing was, my mind would go back to fun every time and never went back to the trouble. And the doctor talks about it. Ken, when he talked last night, he mentioned the book, you know, where we hide all the good information. If you don't have one, get one. And if you get one, read one. I mean, it's just, there's some pictures in there. If you haven't found them, you probably ain't got the one I got, but... kill him. That's the one that done it, I'll tell you that. When I first got, we'll go spiritual for a minute. Ken wanted me to tell you all about this. He was talking to me, you know, and my wife died, and I'll go into that. And she died, and it was a tremendous loss. And after about a year and a half of not being married. I just wasn't used to not being married. I'd been married there for 35 years. I got married. And all the guys around where I live, they'd say, well, Jay, you were so good, dotted on all this horse crap. And they said, you're so spiritual. So this spiritual giant gets married. And it was a nice church wedding, and we go back to my house. And I remember walking in the house, and if she hadn't, you know, I didn't know how to shack up, so I hadn't had a lot of practice with her before we got married. But we walk into the house, and as we walk in, she sits down. And what flashes across this spiritual giant's head inside is a banner that says, why is the bitch sitting in my chair? Now, I didn't say that. I thought that. And pardon the way I expressed it, but that's exactly what I saw. So, you know, doing that deal we do at night, looking back at our day, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm talking about this spiritual giant. I'm saying, you know, where was I wrong? What I knew, I'm thinking to myself, how self-centered I really am. But I masked that phrase. I didn't think I was self-centered. I thought I was set in my ways. Anyhow, those who aren't ready for a spiritual message, go on, go. I never planned on being an alcoholic. Don't know many people that did. I planned on being a lot of other things. Alcoholism was not in my vocabulary. Being an alcoholic was not a plan of mine. I had other goals, but to attain any one of those goals, I would have had to you know, have a discipline in my life and do things and study. And I wasn't willing to pay any of those prices, so I never could accomplish those things that I wanted to accomplish prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, if one of you, if Lily would have said to me, Jay, to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to sacrifice a family. You're going to have to give up a career. You're going to have to put aside every principle or moral value that you've ever discovered in your life. You're going to have to almost die to get here. I'd have said, you're crazy. And yet I prayed to pay just that price. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 30 and a half years old, there was nothing left. I was as close to death as a man could be and still be breathing. I was willing to pay that price, and yet I didn't know the price I'd pay. So when I tell you that I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic, that truly is the whole package. But I didn't know what any of that was. I thought I was normal all my life. As a kid, I was normal. I thought like you thought. I thought we all thought the same way. I had the same stuff going on inside of me. I was mad all the way back as far as I could remember, but I didn't know I was mad. I thought I was normal. I didn't know I was mad till I was sober a year and a half. Ken said, jump right into the steps. Hell, I couldn't jump into nothing when I got here. I was sober a year and a half, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, member of the Nuestra Esperanza group in West Palm Beach, Florida. It was a big book study group. Went to that group every Tuesday night. Went to a lot of other meetings whenever I was off a ship. Real active in the group. I'd been greeter in the group. First thing I got to do was wash ashtrays in the group. That's when all the groups were smoking. I got to wash ashtrays and then you graduate to coffee cups. I didn't like everybody in the group, so I washed coffee cups and ashtrays together. I got to make coffee. Hell, I didn't make it no better than I did the other day. You know, so I didn't make it long, but I was coffee maker. I was chairman. I was everything in that group except treasurer. I still ain't been treasurer. And I'm glad Red and some of the guys from my local area are here. Maybe someday I'll get elected treasurer now. You know, I mean, I always wanted to be treasurer. I guess you got to be careful who you take your fifth step with. I don't know why. Anyhow, but I was sort of a poster child in Alcoholics Anonymous in that group. And then one day at a meeting, I was there saying something real wise. Here I am a year and a half sober, and I went to a big book meeting on Sunday nights where there were some old timers, and I'd listen to them comment. And after they commented, I'd pick up what I heard that was really good and carry it back to my group like it was original. And I'd repeat it. And after the meeting that night, this guy took me aside. His name was John. He put his arm around my shoulder, and he told me that I was a phony and I was about to get drunk. And I hated him. I hated him for saying that, but along with hating him for saying that, I had a comfort inside because I knew that he knew what I felt inside because I knew I was a phony. I know that all I was doing was just not drinking and being active in AA. And John told me that if I didn't do something, I'd be drunk. And he took me home with him that night and set me down on the stoop of his trailer, and he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked to me about the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew the first step. Hell, I'd taken the first step. It says in the book on page whatever, 23, 21, whatever, what it says in there, it says, what about the real alcoholic? It says a delusion that we are like or ever will be like normal drinkers, or when it comes to alcohol, must be smashed. It says, this is the first step in recovery. Well, when it says this is the first step, I thought that was the first step. And I thought that the delusion I had that I could drink like other people, I knew that I couldn't. So that was smashed. But that wasn't the first step. It was the first part of the first step, but I didn't know that. But thinking I knew that, I tried to work the remaining 11 steps. And the results were exactly what the book said. Nil. I didn't know what nil meant, but it didn't mean doing them. I know that. It meant... I had nothing going in my life except I wasn't drinking and I was miserable. And he made me look at my life, and I'll tell you what my life was. My life was a mess. I was married. I'd been married for, I guess, at that time, 10 years. Married to the same woman. And my marriage was in such bad shape that I was the most active member of Sex Without Partners in all of South Florida. Dave, that's a little self-help group down there working its way north. So I wasn't getting along good with my wife, and I wasn't getting along good with the law. They wanted to put me in jail. You see, I'd been over in a country called Ceylon. It's an island off the coast of India, Sri Lanka, they call it now, and I found some guys just like me, active in AA, but didn't have no steps working in their life, and we went into business, the import-export business. We were exporting out of Ceylon and importing into the United States, and we were doing semi-precious gemstones. And we were doing this without the benefit of law. So the government was calling it smuggling. We were calling it business. So I was on the verge of jail, and I was in financial trouble. All my money was gone. I was in debt up to my ears, and I had no way of paying it. Couldn't go, so I was in terrible trouble financially. I was in trouble with the law. I was in trouble with my family. Spiritually, I was bankrupt. I had absolutely nothing going in my life except I wasn't drinking. And when I looked at my life for the very first time, I had that moment of clarity we talk about. I call it a second point of desperation. And it was that point of desperation where I was able to accept the second half of the first step, or the second part of the first step, that my life had become unmanageable. And John had me look at my life in that instant, and I was able to look back and see that my life had been unmanageable from day one. Because from day one, I always knew what I wanted to do, how I had to do it, and how it had to be done, and I'd try and do it. It was unmanageable. And when I accepted unmanageability, John said, simply put, step one means I can't. He had me look at step two, and step two, we've come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. John made it real simple for me. He said, for me, sanity simply was going to be the idea that taking a drink would not be an acceptable alternative. And that's what the book talks about. It doesn't say we won't do crazy things. Hell, we do. I do crazy things all my life. I'll probably always do crazy things. That ain't the insanity the book's talking about. The book's talking about that thing that goes on inside my mind that says, this time I can take a drink and it'll be all right. This time I can take a drink and I won't get drunk, or I won't hurt them, or I won't say that, or I won't do that. And my mind would tell me that, and I'd take that drink and I'd be gone. But if sanity returned, taking a drink would not be an acceptable alternative. Simply put, step two would be, he could. So I had two things in front of me. I can't and he could. And based on that, John had me get on my knees. And I took the third step prayer with John. I read it out of the book. You know, I've memorized literally volumes of information in my life. But I've never memorized that prayer. And yet, from that day to this, on a daily basis, with rare exception, I have prayed that prayer. That does not mean I take the third step every day, because I don't. What I do is reaffirm the decision that I made that day, that night on my knees with John. And as I got off my knees, John handed me a yellow legal tablet. And he said up in the upper left-hand corner, he said, I want you to write the words down I resent. You know, I'm so glad I had a sponsor that when I started with the steps, it wasn't, now we're going to think about what lies ahead. He used the book, and the book uses words like it once and next. You know, it wasn't like, let's talk to 43 people and write four volumes. It was like, let's move on, boy. That was on a Tuesday. He gave me that tablet, and he said at the top of it, write, I resent. And I said, John, I don't resent anybody. And I didn't. I didn't resent a soul in my life. He said, all right. He said, why don't you write down I hate? I could do that. Hell, I hated everybody. I mean, I didn't know that resent was just hate felt over and over again. But, you know, I could hate good. And I mean, I don't know if you could. I liked feeling hate. Hate was sort of like a warm blanket. When I feel hate real good and just think about what I was going to do to them for what they did to me, I get warm all over. I just feel good about it. I go to bed just, oh, God, I'm a... Well, when I put down I hate, I felt good. And he told me who to put down first. I put down the name Siraj. There's an Indian living in my house. I don't mean a Cherokee or a Navajo. I mean an Indian. He's that guy from Ceylon. They sent him over there to watch their money. And he's living in my house. And, God, I hated him. He said, put down why you hate him. And I did. I hated him because he got my money. I hated him because he slept in the bed. My little boy was sleeping on the floor. I hated him because he ate raw meat and we were eating rice and beans because we didn't have any money. I hated him because he wore a dress. Now, they didn't call it a dress. They called it a sari. It is a dress. You put a man in a skirt, it's a dress. I'll tell you, I don't care. John told me it wasn't important whether it made sense or not, but if I felt it, if I thought it, put it down. And I went back through my life and saw the hate and anger ran back through my life all the way to when I was a child. I hated my parents for what I perceived that they hadn't done. My dad had never been my friend as a kid. My dad was a news commentator and analyst in Cleveland, Ohio. He had a coast-to-coast hookup. He was a big shot and made a lot of money. And my dad just never did the things with me that I thought a dad should do. We didn't go camping. We didn't play ball. We didn't do things. And if we did do things, I don't remember doing them. I just never felt that kind of relationship that I thought I should have felt. And I hated my dad for not giving me that, and I hated my mother. I knew my mother didn't like me. She liked my sisters. I had three sisters. And she liked them, but she didn't like me, and I knew that. I didn't feel I was a part of that family. I had absolutely no use for them. I found that I had that running through me all the way back to when I was a kid. There was no reason to have that, but it was there. And I think those kind of feelings are a part of alcoholism. But it is anger and that kind of stuff. But it doesn't make you an alcoholic. It just makes you nuts as a kid. And you couldn't tell anyone about it. I couldn't. I remember seeing people all through my youth they'd have me see counselors and psychologists and this one and that one and social workers, and they'd say, well, tell me what's going on. I couldn't tell them. I knew I couldn't tell them because they didn't understand. I knew in my head they wouldn't understand, so why waste my time? So that's all going on. Hell, I ain't, that's as far back as I can remember. I was a liar since I can first remember. And I never set out to be a liar. When I discovered that I was a liar, I was glad of it. Because I thought lying was a gift from God. I thought God gave us this thing that made us able to lie where we could believe it. You know, I think, who was it? I think it was Linda yesterday, or and Lily mentioned it about how this not being able to tell the truth from false, you know. I was able to do that before I ever took a drink. And it just came natural. There wasn't no books out on how to do it, you know. It wasn't like a, you know, a home study course. It just came. And lying like that set myself up for the lie that almost killed me. The lie that this time I can take a drink and it'll be different. This time I can take a drink and I won't hurt her. Or I won't go there. Or I won't do that. And I believe that lie, and I take that drink and it'd be worse than it was the last time I took it. But I had the lying going on before the drink. So I think that ability, that's a part of my alcoholism. Stealing. I was a thief as far back as I can remember. I didn't think I was a thief, but I was a thief. When you take something ain't yours, you're a thief. I thought I was Robin Hood. I don't know. I mean, I might take something from Ted. I'd turn around and give it to Linda. And it wouldn't be the idea that I thought I was taking from him. I thought if I give it to her, she'd say I was a good guy and she'd want me around. I never thought about the fact that he might have worked hard to earn the money to pay for whatever it was that I took. That never entered my mind. Nobody taught me that. It just came natural. And if I was talking to one of them counselors or social workers and told them that, they'd have probably told me that I was trying to buy someone's attention or affection. And I guess I was. But I didn't know that I was. It was just natural with me. So when I say I thought I was normal, that's what I thought normal was. Thinking like that and behaving like that long before I ever went to school, and I went off to the first grade. We've heard talk here about Catholicism, parochial school. I went to one of them parochial schools. I remember a first grade teacher I had. Her name was Sister Lucy. God, I close my eyes, I can picture her. She was sort of early S&M. She was about this tall. She had a black thing that went from her head all the way down to her boots. She wore boots with heels on them. She had leather and chains hanging down the side, and they made noise when she walked. She's a scary sight. I have seen her later. My sister, a year younger than I am, is now a member of that order, and she's been a member for over 40 years, and I have seen Sister Lucy as she got older and older. She's just a loving, nice woman, but I didn't see it that way as a little kid going into the first grade. You know, and I was scared of her. And I remember what happened. You know, in the first grade, they called my parents in halfway through the first grade, and they wanted to have a discussion with them. And I thought it was over my behavior, but it wasn't, because I was standing outside eavesdropping, and this nun told my parents that it appeared as though I was a very gifted child, and that I'd be able to go anywhere or do anything. And at that point, my education stopped. You know, I hear people talk about going to college and going to high school and doing this. For me, none of that was going to happen, because all of a sudden I was so smart I couldn't learn anything. And I began getting in trouble. And I'm not going to go through all of it, but I got locked up about 2 years after that in the third grade. I got locked up for running away because I wanted to be out of the situation I was in. I thought things would be better. And behaving I was and running the way I was wound up in front of the juvenile referee, and he sent me to an institution. And I was there for a short period of time, came out, and they sent me to another institution. And to make that story even shorter, I was to stay locked up for most of the next 9 years until I was 17 and a half years old. And I never wanted it to be that way. And I graduated from one to another, so I was in reform school and reformatories. And I didn't want it to be that way. I wanted to be like the other kids that I'd see and be happy and have that kind of home. And it wasn't that way. It got worse. And at 13 years old, a miracle come into my life. At 13 years old, I made a conscious decision to drink. And I'm sure I'd had alcohol in me many times before then because of the environment I grew up in. My dad was a drinker. My dad drank morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week. I never saw him drunk, never saw him slur his words or fall down. He always drank. My mom drank every night, two or three drinks to relax. They'd have family get-togethers, and when they get together, all uncles and aunts, everybody comes around, and us kids would get some of what the adults had. We'd get a little bit of what they had, and it was just normal. It was a part of it, and that was just, I don't remember specifics, but I know that it was there. And I guess that was my social drinking, because it meant nothing to me and did nothing for me. Hell, I was married to a social drinker. I was married to her 35 years. If I'd asked her any time during the marriage when she had her last drink, she couldn't have told me. If I asked her when she had any drink, she couldn't have told me. Didn't do nothing for her. Didn't do nothing to her. And that's social drinking. And that was me till 13. But at 13, I decided to drink. So I stole some money from my mother's purse, and since I knew I didn't look 21, you had to be 21 and a high to drink, I stole an eyebrow pencil, and I gave myself a beard and a mustache. I mean, just sort of dotted on a 5 o'clock shadow. Now, Al, I wasn't, you know, I was 13 years old. I hadn't cultivated my first zit yet, for God's sakes, you know. I can only imagine what it looked like. I'd love to have a picture of it. I headed down to the lower end of 25th Street, which was a skid row in Cleveland, Ohio. And as I headed down there, because I'd learned that's where you can get something to drink, the place I'd been locked up, I headed on down there to drink with this other guy, and we went into a number of gin mills, finally got what we wanted. We got 2 bottles of mint screwdrivers and 2 bottles of Thunderbird wine. And I can only imagine why I ordered. I remember ordering the 2 bottles of both of them, screwdrivers, because it promised something. It sounded sexual. I wasn't sure what it meant, but it sounded real good. And Thunderbird, because of what I'd heard about it. There's a billboard on 25th and Scranton, and I'll tell you, it's the most beautiful billboard I'd ever seen. It was as big as that wall. It showed this big bottle and showed this bird just soaring through the air. I mean, just looking good. And it had the words I'd learned with, you know, like, what's the word? Thunderbird. By God, it promised something was going to happen. If you think I'm kidding, try and do that with Muscatel. Even Mad Dog. It don't have that same... And it was priced right. I could afford it. I could afford it then. I could afford it at the end of my drinking. It was the cheapest stuff they had on the market. In fact, if you're still there, you look around, you'll find it. But you got to look real low. They keep it on the lowest shelves of the stores. It's like they want you to steal it. The good stuff they keep up here where they can watch it. We got that stuff and left that place and went out behind some bushes. We started to drink. I don't know what one we started with. I don't know what it tasted like. But shortly after we started, things happened. And for the first time in my life, I felt okay. And it had to be the most fantastic feeling a guy like me could ever have felt. Because I pursued the recapturing of it at every opportunity for the next 17 years. And every time I chased it, it got worse. And I woke up the next morning in a way that I was going to wake up in over and over again. I woke up in a mess and it was mine. I woke up with a new fear about me. I didn't know it was a new fear, but I was taking that inventory I was telling you about. You know, after I got through with the resentment part, my sponsor had me go to fears, had me list them. I put them all down, put down who I was afraid of, why I was afraid. And I got them all down. I told John, I said, well, John, there they are. And he said, well, let's get on our knees. And I asked God to remove them. Got off my knees, I was still afraid. And John said, what are you afraid of? I said, I don't know. And he showed me where Bill writes about the fear of impending calamity. And I didn't know what impending calamity meant. But John put it in words that made sense to me. He said, that's the fear that something bad's going to happen, and you can't stop it. I knew that fear. And I could see it was just like Bill talked about, an evil and corroding threat. Our lives are shot through with it. It ought to be classed with stealing. I could see where that fear threaded back through my life to those early teen years. And as it grew, as time went on, my alcoholism progressed, that fear grew. And there'd be times it'd be gone, then it'd be back stronger than ever. By the time I got to you, that fear was killing me. The only time I didn't have it was when I was blacked out or passed out. And when I come to, it'd be there. And the last day before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wouldn't go away anymore. You know, I see that fear a lot. I'm very fortunate. I get to make 12-step calls and work with new guys. You know, I go to a guy's house. In my house or trailer, whatever he's got, won't be no electricity. No food for the kids. 3 tires on the car. No job, but by God, there's caller ID on a cell phone. I understand that. You know, I was a guy that if there was a knock on the door, I didn't want to answer it. If there was an envelope with no return address, I wouldn't open it. If there was some registered mail, I never picked it up. I knew that fear. Got on my knees with John one more time and asked God to remove it, and the fear was taken from me. And I'd like to tell you it's never come back from then till now, but that'd be a lie. Because you see, every once in a while, they'll start coming back. I'll wake up out of that little dread inside of me. And I know what's going on. It's time for me to take a look right then at what I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing or what I'm not doing that I should be doing. I ask God to help me make those changes and ask him to take the fear, and it's gone. And I've got a little prayer that I say on a real regular basis, not just at those times, but at other times. Ken was talking last night about living in the now. And this is a prayer I use for that. God, you take it. I can't handle it. God, you take it. I can't handle it. And if you have trouble going to sleep tonight, if you have trouble, just try to forget about counting sheep. Just start saying that over and over again. God, you take it. I can't handle it. And you'll be surprised. The next thing you know, you'll be waking up. Because when I give it to God, he takes it. And he took the fear that night. It was to be a few years before I drank again because I was locked up on an indefinite sentence. I went away to a reformatory, ran away from there when I was 17 and a half years old. I got a chance to get away and got away, went back down on a skid row and got signed into the Navy. My career in the Navy takes very little time to talk about. I was there less than 6 months. But it was an important decision going in. You see, I wanted things to be different. I wanted to be like the guy that I saw on the recruiting poster. So I went away. They needed to get my parents' signature, so I went back out and got them. And I wrote my parents a letter later and told them where I was. You know, they don't know who's signing when you go outside. But I wrote my parents and told them where I was. I was in the service, and they wrote me back. And they said they were proud of me, that I was making a positive move in my life. And they were going to come watch me graduate from boot camp. That may not sound like a big deal to you, but it was a big deal to them because I'd given them nothing to be proud of. Found out later what had happened. As soon as I ran away from that reformatory, the very first place the law went was to my parents' house. I was the guy they wanted back in jail, and my parents went to the juvenile authorities and petitioned them to allow me to stay in the service. And back then, back in the late 50s, early 60s, they would let you go into the service instead of being in jail as a youthful offender, and the courts agreed to let me stay. And had I known my parents had gotten involved then, I wouldn't have been grateful and said thank you. I'll tell you what I'd have felt. I'd have thought inside of me, why don't you leave me alone, let it do it my way. Quit messing in my life. You see, no matter what was done to me, I thought it was done to me, not for me. I could never imagine anyone did anything to help me. They always did things to get involved and to mess up my life, not to help me. That's how my mind worked. But they came up and they watched this ceremony. This was a graduation ceremony. It wasn't much. They carried me into Chicago on a 12-hour pass. I remember going down to this restaurant with my mom and dad. And my dad, we walked in, and my dad said, son, you're not legally old enough to drink, but if you can be in the service and you want to drink, I'll buy you one. What do you have? What an act of unconditional love. Really, I mean, you know, and in my mind, the thought went through it that now my dad and I will be drinking buddies, and I felt good about it. And I said, I'll have a beer. And he ordered me a beer. He ordered himself a cup of coffee and my mother a Coca-Cola. And I looked at him and said, what's the matter? Aren't you drinking? I never knew him not to drink. And my mother looked at me and she had that funny look in her eyes some of these women get, or guys. She said, no, your daddy doesn't drink anymore. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been sober for 3 months. I'll tell you about my dad. My dad got sober at a place called Rosary Hall in Cleveland, Ohio, back when Sister Ignatia run it. And my dad, back then it was a 3 to 5 day drying out joint is all it was. And the only way you got in, your AA sponsor checked you in, and when you got out, your AA sponsor picked you up. And the only stuff you read in there was the big book, The 12 and 12 and the Grapevine. There was no TVs or radios. The only people that saw you was your sponsor and the people your sponsor put on a visiting list for you. My daddy was there for 5 days, and they told me later he lay in straps in the hallway. They wouldn't give him a room because he was in convulsions, and they thought he'd die. And he was only out of that for less than 3 months when he came to see this graduation deal. And I know how I felt at 3 months sober, so I can only imagine how he felt. At 3 months sober, drinking was always on my mind. All I thought about was drinking. I wasn't drinking, but I thought about drinking. I'm sure Dad was still thinking about drinking because he was a good bit older than I was when he got sober. But instead of him thinking about not drinking, he offered to buy me a drink if I wanted it. No judgment. And you would have thought I'd have seen that as love. But you know what I saw it as? I looked at my watch and I thought to myself, how soon can I be away from these people and meet my friends and drink? I knew the only reason he wasn't drinking was because he didn't love me. And I wanted to get away from him. And I met my friends and I drank. I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up the last time, but it was different now. Now I had the rules and regulations of service around me, and I don't like authority. I don't know many alcoholics that do. If I took a poll in here, there's a hell of a lot of unemployed, self-employed, or salesmen in here, I'll bet you that. Or retired, you know, I mean, we ain't big on authority. It's okay, you know, it's not a negative, but hell, I never did like it. I was in the service, and if you don't like authority, that's a bad place to be, am I right? I mean, it don't work real good. So my career in the service was very short-lived. 5 months or almost 6 months after I went in, I wound up in a room about half this side. It was the nut ward of the Naval Hospital in Pensacola, Florida. That's before they offered treatment for alcoholism. They didn't offer nothing. They called me before board officers, and they give me a paper. They said, if you sign this paper, we'll give you an honorable discharge. If you don't, we're going to court-martial you. That's an easy decision to make. I signed the paper. Asked them what it was. They said, it's a guarantee you'll never attempt to reenlist in any of the armed forces as long as you live. That's 40-some years ago. I've lived up to it pretty good. I ain't going back. That's one promise I kept, I'll tell you. But they went on to tell me that I had what they would term to be acute alcoholism. They said by acute alcoholism, we mean when you drink, you get in trouble. Well, I knew when I drank, I got in trouble, but they had it backwards. They thought drinking got me in trouble. I knew it wasn't drinking that got me in trouble. You got me in trouble. If you didn't talk about me, if you didn't pick on me, if you'd give me a break, if you'd do this, it was always you, them, or that. It was never me. I'll give you an instance. I could be sitting in a bar. The bar could be twice the size of this room, completely empty, just me, the bartender, and a jukebox. I love country music. I don't know if you do or not. I loved it. And I loved it drinking. I like it sober. Some of the songs are made for drinkers. You stop and think of some of them. You know, Bubba Shot the Jukebox. You know, you remember that song? I was sober when it came out. I could think about that sober and think it made sense. That, you know, the jukebox needed shooting. I can understand that. But I'd be sitting there thinking and drinking, and I'd look up, and there'd be two of them back in the corner, and they'd be talking about me. I was absolutely no bigger then than I am now. I was a little skinnier then, as a matter of fact, and I'd go over to straighten them out for talking about me. Hell, they didn't even know I was there, but my mind said they were talking about me. I was always a fighter, but I was always a loser. You know, I'd get in trouble. And I'd go back to the ship, sometimes with clothes on and sometimes with clothes off, and always in trouble. And I woke up that morning that way, and these guys told me, they said that if I quit drinking then I could have a good life, but if I continued it wouldn't be long and I'd be chronic. This is the day before my 18th birthday, and they're telling me I could be a chronic alcoholic. Are they out of their minds? I ain't even had a date yet, for Christ's sake. Well, I wouldn't tell you if I had. You know where I was locked up, all male environment. You know, this ain't a fifth step. I said, give me them papers, I'll be on my way. And they gave me the pay I had coming and did an honorable discharge, and I headed back to my parents' house, headed from Florida back to Ohio. And I got up there, and it was my 18th birthday, and I celebrated by buying a car as a Studebaker. You ever see one of them? You don't know if it's coming or going? They're old cars. But anyhow, I bought one of them, and I got a driver's license, and that's as far as I went. I went to celebrate my birthday, and I got arrested that night. And I woke up the next morning, same way I woke up the last time I drank. Same mess, same fear, same not knowing what happened the night before. And it was different. I was in jail. First time I'd been locked up in jail for that. And the cops come and got me in the morning, and they let me out. And they give me 8 traffic violations for hit, skip, and drunk driving, and driving with no insurance. They had all kinds of stuff. Only thing I'd done right is have a license, you know. And they took that away, and I was sober 2.5 years before I ever got it back again. Now, that was a long time. That was, what, 17 years, 16 years from then before I got the license back. I didn't mean I quit driving. I kept driving. I just didn't have good licenses. That's 40 years of computers and technology. I could go to California and get one and go to Texas. And just, you know, you lose that, you go somewhere, go to Oregon, get one. And you just keep getting them. It took them a long time to catch up with you. And I'd keep getting them taken away. One time I was driving an ambulance in Florida in between ships, saving lives. And same deal, you know, drunk. I don't remember it. I mean, I think it was misrepresented. But I learned, when I got that job, I learned that oxygen will help with a hangover. Now, we were trying to help this woman. The tanks were empty. We got rid of hangovers for too long, I reckon, but my driving career was not real good, in other words. But I got out of jail, and I went over to my mother's house. And as I walked in, because that's where they towed the car to, and my mother was really, it was bad. The only reason they let me out is because my mother was clerk of courts in that suburb of Cleveland. And I walked into the house, and she's sitting there crying. And my sister was with her, and I asked my sister, I said, what's wrong? I'm thinking to myself, why is she crying? I'm the one who got out of jail. I ought to be crying. And my mother told me, she said, I'm so afraid. I said, what's that? She said, you make me so ashamed the way you live and the way you behave. She said, since your father got sober, but then my father was sober like 6 months or 9 months. She said, since your father got sober, she said, I felt that I was blessed. She said, because I'm pregnant. And it was going to be a midlife baby for her. And she said, but right now I'm so afraid that this child will be born a boy, that I'm praying that it'll self-abort or be born dead rather than be born a boy. How many times have I said in my life when people say you're destroying things, you're hurting people, I say you're crazy. The only guy I'm hurting is myself. I'm not hurting anybody but me. And I didn't feel what you just felt when I told you that. I tell you what I felt. I felt anger. How could she say that? And I left there and went on my way. I never stayed there again. And I went to sea. I joined the Merchant Marine. I had read some books about going to sea, and the Merchant Marine, it sounded like a very romantic way to go, make a lot of money, travel around. So I got on my first ship, and I went to Japan, went to the West Coast, got in the Union, went on a ship, went to Japan. And I remember going ashore in Japan, And when I got ashore, I took a drink, and it was 3 days later, a captain came and got me. And I don't know what happened between taking the drink and him coming to get me. But he got me out of jail in Japan, in Yokohama, Japan. He brought me back to the ship, and he put me in the official log, which means you're fired when they put you in there. And you dock 3 days' pay, and you're fired. And I was real concerned. And the guys told me, don't worry about that. We all get fired or quit. He said, what do you think they're going to do, make you walk home? I mean, you know, it's like, it's not a big deal. And I did the math, then they told me about this. We got 300 ships under union agreement. Each ship's a separate entity. Each voyage, 3 or 4 months. Well, each ship's a different company, 3 or 4 months. I did it. I'd have to be 110 years old to run out of companies to work for. If I got fired from every one, I was bound not to get fired from some. So I said, oh, my job's secure. My employment will be secure. And I didn't worry about it. And I kept going to sea and getting in trouble, and things kept getting worse. And I wanted it to get better, and I put rules in my drinking, and the rules wouldn't work, so I changed the rules, and it kept getting worse. And I made a study one night, and I said, you know, I observed the only people that are getting in trouble are guys like me. If I get married and have a family, things would get a lot better. Married people don't have these kind of difficulties. So I was sitting in a bar one day shopping for this wife, and she walked in. And all I ever did by then was go to sea and drink, you know. And she walked in. She's just a little bitty old redhead. She sat down next to me, and by God, she was mad. I took one look at her, and there's a woman madder than I'd ever been. She sat down there, and I said, can I buy you a drink? And the reason I was in that bar was another woman in there I'd been trying to put the move on, hadn't gotten over with, was a barmaid. And my wife's girlfriend was the daughter of the barmaid. So anyway, I look over to her and say, can I buy you a drink? And she says, no, I don't drink. Well, hell, that was true love right there. I couldn't afford a drinker. I knew that. I just got off a ship, had all them $100 bills. I sort of smeared them out on the bar. I began to lie, and she started to listen. I found out why she was mad. She'd been married for a number of years to a guy who'd been very, very physically abusive. She had 2 children, one just a few months old at that time, or a little less than a year, and one 4 years old. She hated men. She hated life. And she hated anything to do with drinking. Now, there's a challenge. After a lengthy courtship, I proposed to her. Were Von here for you to talk to, she'd tell you it's about 10 minutes. I think it's a lot longer, 20 minutes or so anyhow. I really do. I know alcoholics take a long time with those important decisions, and so 20 minutes sounds about reasonable. But she said, you're crazy. She said, I'm not divorced. I said, so what? Then he had to make a long story short, on October 14th, 1965, Her divorce was final, and October 15, 1965, we got married. We got married at the Candlelight Flower Shop in West Palm Beach, Florida, on Congress Avenue, and I'll never forget it. I remember as we got married what I thought about. You know, my family, I don't know anyone that ever been divorced. When you got married, you just got married. That's just, I'm not judging or saying. I'm just saying that's what was in my head, how I understood life. You got married, you just stayed married. And I was getting married, going to stay married. Didn't mean, you know, that was it. And these 2 kids, I wanted to be their dad. I wanted to be her husband. I wanted to be all the things this woman that she had never had. I wanted to give her security. I wanted to be a faithful husband. I wanted to give her financial security. And because I wanted to do it, I thought I could do it. A little boy hanging onto my leg, Ricky, he's looking up at me crying. He said, please be my daddy. Me never having a daddy growing up, never feeling this relationship with a dad, I was going to be his daddy. Holding little Kim in my arms. Kim was less than 2 years old. We got married. And I was going to be her daddy. And I could just picture her whole life with me as her daddy. Picture my whole life as this woman's husband. And the good husband I'd be. I thought because I wanted to do it, I could do it. I didn't know that lack of power was my dilemma. I thought that wanting was enough power. And we got married. And I was on an enforced period of sobriety because one of the conditions of getting married was that I wouldn't drink, so I didn't drink until we got married. But we got married, and we went over to her aunt's house. They had a little reception for us. It wasn't much. It was just a little reception. Walked in, they had a big thing of punch. I hate punch. But they had punch, and they had, you know, toasters and stuff. And they gave me a glass of that punch, and I remember taking a drink of it. And I remember spitting it out. There wasn't no liquor in it. The only time you can ever drink punch is there's so much vodka you don't know it's punch. And I've been to weddings. Now, I didn't know the people getting married, but I've been to a lot of weddings. And you go to weddings. You go to a big city, and you go to Polish or Italian wedding, maybe Irish. I'll have to check with Ken on that. But you go where there's a big crowd there, and if you wear a nice suit and don't throw up or start making any trouble, you can drink for a long time. As soon as you puke once, you're out of there, believe me. But I'm at my wedding to celebrate, and there's no one drinking, and I was mad. And I grabbed my new wife, same woman I'm going to be a good husband to, and took her out of there. We got in an old car, headed down to Miami for a two-day honeymoon. And I wanted to drink, and I stopped at a liquor store and got a bottle, and I started drinking. And she wouldn't celebrate with me, so I picked a guy up on the side of the road. He was just a bum. We passed the bottle back and forth across my new wife. And I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up whenever I drank by then. Not remembering what happened the night before. Had that fear going on inside of me. Didn't know what I'd done, what I'd said, and her laying next to me, crying. And everyone in here knows the kind of tears I'm describing. I don't mean the stuff that runs out of your eyes. I'm talking about that deep down in the chest racking, that when you hear the person crying, you hurt as badly as the one doing the crying. And that thing going on in my mind, how can I stop this? And I remember asking her, what's wrong? And I knew what was wrong. And her telling me. She said, I've lived this way before, and I will not live this way again. And I took that vow. I said, I'm sorry, and I love you. And if you give me one more chance, I will never behave this way again. And she believed me. That was on October 16th, 1965. It was a lot of years until March the 8th of 1974. And I cannot take the time to take you day by day through the hell that that was going to be for she and for I, for the two kids that came with the marriage, for the little boy, Jay, that was born in 1968. But it was a nightmare that got worse and worse. And I don't know how we stayed together. I can only guess. I went to sea, and I'd be gone for 3 months, 6 months, one time a year, be gone all over the world. And when I'd write her letters, I'd write her long, long love letters. Every day I'd write these letters, and I meant every word that I wrote in them. I'd tell her how things were going to be different, how I'd be different, things would be better. And I'd mail them off. Whenever the mail would go, she'd get stacks of them. They'd be numbered. And by the time I got home, she'd had all those letters and read them, and I'd get home. And she'd be there at the airport, and that's when you get near where the planes were. She'd be there with the kids, all three of the kids then, and two kids then, the three of them. They'd be waiting, and she'd have that smile on her face. Her husband was home, and everything was great until I get close enough to her where she could smell me, because I'd be drunk. And the hope would go out of her eyes as though you threw ice water on her. And it got worse. In 1973, I got blackballed out of the U.S. Merchant Marine for chronic alcoholism. They labeled me a performer, and that's just an acronym they use. It means you don't perform. They threw me out of the union and threw me off the ships. On March the 7th of 1974, I found myself knocking on a man's back door 1,200 miles away from where we lived. And when he answered the door, the first words out of my mouth were, I think I have a problem drinking. I have no idea where that came from, because I hadn't asked for help. I hadn't done anything. I just said, I think I have a problem drinking. I hadn't drawn a sober breath in I don't know how long. And that man laughed. Ken mentioned laughter last night and about those endorphins. I'll tell you what, laughter is healthy. I love laughter. I remember his laugh. It wasn't a laugh of meanness. It was a laugh of love. He said, come on in. And he took me into his house. He sat me down on a sofa in his study. And he reached into his desk and he brought out a copy of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The same book that was given to that young man last night with the one day of sobriety. He gave me that book and he had me open it up. And on a flyleaf, there were some words written. And he said, read them, and I did, and it said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, God will help. And it was from Johnson, who was signed, Love, Dad. My dad had bought that book many years before, as I was going down this road. And he put it aside, and I'm so glad my dad hadn't heard the words that are sort of catchwords today, like intervention. He had talked to you about it. He'd come to you, and he'd say, what can we do about my son? And you people told him, leave me alone. You said, don't get in his way. Don't say anything, because he's never listened to you before. Why would he listen to you now? And I'm glad that you told him that, because had he interfered before I was ready to ask for help, I might not have had nowhere to go. You see, I had all the intervention I ever needed in my life. I've been locked up more times than I want to count. I've been thrown out of her house. I've been thrown off jobs. That's intervention. Didn't mean a damn thing. It was only when something happened inside of here where I said, something's wrong, that I was able to say, I think I have a problem drinking. And then my dad didn't give me the message. What my dad did was, he said, come with me. He said, we'll go to a meeting tonight, and I'll introduce you to some people. He's going to take me to the message. But I said, no, I'm drunk. He said, that's all right. He tried to talk me into going, but I wouldn't go. And so he wrote down two numbers on a piece of paper, and he said, tomorrow morning, he said, when you wake up, if you wake up, if you live, he said, and you want to be sober more than you want to be drunk, call one of these numbers before you take a drink. And then meet me tomorrow night, and we'll go to a meeting. And I went out that night. I don't know where I went. I just know that I drank. And I know I woke up the next morning and there was a drink next to me. And because there was always a drink next to me then, there was always something there. I never went to bed without something next to me. And it was laying there next to me, and when I got up, I needed that drink, and I wanted that drink. But as much as I wanted it and needed it, something was different. And that something different is the thing that we talk about here. The something different was that I didn't want it just a little bit more. We see that saying in our meetings room, but for the grace of God. Grace comes from a Latin word that means gift. And I believe God's unasked for gift to me that morning was that desire not to drink that was stronger than the desire to drink. And I believe that gift that was given to me was the same gift that was given to you and was given to you with a responsibility that you do everything you can to keep it or you lose it. That day I couldn't do much. I just didn't drink, and I was sick, and I wanted to drink. But she took me to the hospital. She, meaning my wife, she didn't have a name by then, but she took me to the hospital 6 o'clock in the morning. And they gave me a shot. And back then, it wasn't fancy drugs. It was vitamin B12. They said it'd work. I don't know what it did. If I remember right, needles was about that long, and they were square. And there must be a spot on our left cheek that's tattooed, because they seemed to hit it with unerring accuracy every day. But that nurse had plunged that in there and said, this will help. And, you know, she rammed that bugger in there. And I don't know if B12 helped or not, but I didn't drink. And I got them every day for 2 weeks. And then after that, they told her to give me honey and orange juice. Now, they said honey and orange juice has the same physical stuff that alcohol does. It helped me withdraw. So we didn't get along good. She got K-Row syrup and orange juice. Early March in Ohio, northern Ohio, K-Row syrup and orange juice is about like road tar. It'll cut your throat going down, I'll tell you that. But she told me I'd just drink that stuff. And then they said whenever I was irritable or angry, give me some candy. That would help withdraw. She got Sour Balls. My mouth was sucked back for 3 months. But not. But the candy works. The deal is you work with a newcomer, get them candy. But get them chocolate, caramel or something. You know, get them, you know. Love and tolerance of others is our code. She hadn't read that. But anyhow, I met my dad that night. I met him at 7 o'clock. We went to a meeting. It was a meeting like this with people like you. We come in the back door, and there's this guy standing there. Had a Levi coat on, a baseball cap. And it was a snowy night. I remember walking in, and this guy stuck his hand out and grabbed mine. And my dad said, that's Jimmy. He's your sponsor. My dad takes off, and I got this yo-yo hanging onto my hand. And I pray to God I never forget it. He said, my name's Jimmy, and I'm glad to meet you. And it was just something about what he said in his handshake that I'll never forget. I just felt that I was supposed to feel it. His hand was firm, and it was warm, and it was dry. It was the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know what my hand was. My hand was wet, and it was cold, and it was scared. As he shook my hand and said he was glad to meet me, I just accepted it. And he began to do something nobody had ever done. He began to talk to me about his alcoholism. He didn't use that word. He talked to me about what happened when he drank. He talked to me what happened with his family, with his kids. What happened with his jobs, where his life was going, what had happened, and how bad it was. And as he was relating those things to me, I knew that he had lived the way I'd lived. We had nothing in common. I never worked in a factory like he did or did the thing, but I knew he thought just like I thought. And then he told me something. He said, and I haven't had a drink. At that time, it was 3 years. And then the meeting started, and some guy told his story like I'm telling mine. And I don't know what the guy said. It wasn't no dissertation on the steps or nothing. It was just his story. All I remember about that meeting is I laughed. Ken talked about laughter last night, and laughter is great, because you can't think when you laugh. And for a new guy, that's great. Well, for an old guy, that's great. You know what I mean? But I remember laughing at that meeting. Whatever somebody said made me laugh, and that laughter attracted me back again. And then Jimmy talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me, he said, Jay, how do you feel? And I told him I was scared and I was sick. And I had a lot of legal stuff happening then and a lot of other stuff, And he said, I understand. And, you know, here's a guy that's never thought that anyone could ever understand. When he said, I understand, it just rang true with me. I knew that he did. And then he said, I'm going to make you a promise. If you do 3 things on a daily basis, I guarantee you'll never have to come off another drunk. Will you do them? And I said, yeah, what are they? He said, number one, he said, I want you, when you get up in the morning, you say, God, help me not take a drink today. Number two, if you can, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you may not be able to go some days. You'll be back at sea, but if you can, go. Number three, when you go to bed at night, say, thank you, God, for a sober day. He said, can you do it? And I said, Jimmy, I can go to meetings, but I can't pray. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can't. I said, I told him how I was raised and told him I didn't really have a belief, didn't know what God was or wasn't. I didn't believe in nothing, really. And I was trying to be honest with him. I remember him laughing then, again, laughing. And he said, now you don't have to believe. Just say the words. And that's what the book says. The book does not say you got to believe. The book says if you believe or are even willing to believe, you're on your way. And all Jimmy was doing was establishing willingness. And I began to do that. Every morning I get up and I felt like a phony and a hypocrite and I didn't mean it. I thought about drinking. As I'm thinking about drinking, I'm saying, God, help me not drink today. And I go to bed at night and there wasn't no question about going to a meeting because he was there and we went to a meeting. It wasn't like I had a pressing social calendar or anything. He just said, I'm picking you up. Back then they didn't say, what are you doing tomorrow? He just said, I'm picking you up. Well, he picked me up. We went to a meeting. By the time I realized I had a choice, I was screwed. I was in that rhythm, you know. I was done. So, but he'd say, I'm picking you up. We went to a meeting and said, let's do another talk. They were all speaker talks. And we get down there and I go home and I say, thank you for a sober day. And I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. I think I wish I'd have been drunk today. But I'd say the words he told me to say. I remember the second day going to a meeting. And don't get nervous. I ain't going through 30 years of sobriety with you day at a time. But I'm going to tell you a couple of days. The second day we're going to a meeting and he looked over at me and he said, Jay, have you had a drink since last night? You know, that's the dumbest question he could ever ask me. He didn't drop me off till 2 in the morning. He called me at 6 for the shot. Checked at 8 to make sure I got home. Called at noon. Called at 4. Picked me up at 7. How could I drink? There was no time. But I didn't tell him that. I said, no. He said, man, that's fantastic. He said, do you know you just stayed sober the longest period of time you'll ever have to stay sober? I said, what do you mean? I thought he was nuts. What about Thanksgiving? He said, no, man. He said, one day. All we do this deal for is one day, and you did it. Now you use that experience for tomorrow. If you ever drink now, it's because you want to, not because you have to. He took away every excuse with that. He didn't say 90 and 20 or whatever the hell it is. He said, today, that was it. Thank God for simplicity for a guy like me. 2 weeks into Alcoholics Anonymous, just before I go back to Florida, I remember Jimmy talking to me. We're on our way back from a meeting, and I said, Jimmy, I still don't believe in this God nonsense. I just don't believe in it. He said, that's okay. He said, but I'm going to ask you something. He said, tonight was the first time you've done anything in AA except drink coffee and the cookies. What was it? I said, well, I read the traditions. He said, before you read the traditions, what did you say? I said, I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic. He said, you believe that? And I did. By then I accepted what the book said. I accepted what it said, where it says, what about the real alcoholic? He or she may or may not be a heavy drinker, may or may not be a daily drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career begins to lose control once he starts to drink. I fit that. I had that. I knew about the allergy. I knew if I took a drink, I couldn't stop. I accepted that. And as I told him that, he said, hell, I knew you were, but I wanted to make sure you knew you were. He said, have you been doing what I told you to do every morning and every night? And I said, yeah. I said, I feel like a phony and I don't believe it, but I've been doing it. He said, that's great. He said, how long you been doing it? And I told him, 13 days or 14, well, it was a long time, I'll tell you that, a day at a time. He said, man, that's fantastic. He said, when was the last time you've been this long without a drink? And an awareness came over me that I can only share with you. It was an awareness that there was a power in my life. Today I call God that had allowed me not to drink a day at a time for that unbelievably long period of time. God became a power. God no longer became a name or a thing. God became a power personal to me that did personal things for me, not to me. And he allowed me not to drink when I wanted to drink and needed a drink. And from that relationship, from the birth of that relationship, that really was born of my willingness to say words I didn't believe that I didn't want. That's grown into a relationship that would take me 30 years to tell you about. And the journey has been absolutely fantastic. Yes, great things have come to pass. It's a different man standing here that came to Alcoholics Anonymous 30 years ago. The guy that came to Alcoholics Anonymous wanted to do things and couldn't do anything. Today, the guy that's standing before you can do absolutely nothing, but God can do it all. As a result of following your directions, things happened. John started the steps with me on a Tuesday. By Friday, I was making amends. Because Tuesday, we looked at the first three steps. Wednesday, I took an inventory. Thursday was the fifth step, six and seven. I did my eighth step on Friday, and I began to make amends. John believed in the book and moving along. You know, this crap about making it a three-year seminar, I wasn't going to get it. I'd have been dead. I called my mother that weekend, the woman that I hated because she didn't want a son. We had no relationship. I really hated her. I didn't like her, never liked her, and I hated her. And I called my mother. And I said, "Hi, Mom, this is Jay." She said, "I know." I said, "I've been meaning to call you." And I said, "I'll call next week." That was all the conversation was, because there was nothing to say. But I began to call every Sunday, and I began to build a relationship, because John said, "Your mother did the best she could do." Isn't that right? And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you did the best you could do, but now you can do a little better." And the way you build a relationship, he says, is by taking action. You don't say, "I'm sorry," and you don't talk about what you've done. You begin doing something different. And I began to act like a loving son should act. And I began to call my mother every weekend. And I'd call her on her birthday and, you know, on special occasions. And I began to remember what we talked about. We began to build a rapport and a friendship and a relationship. I began to talk to my dad. My dad and I never got warm and fuzzy. But I began to build a relationship with him. And John made me do that in all my amends. He did not allow me to just say, "I'm sorry for what I've done." He made me go to people and make things right. The Indian that I brought to my house that was mentioned at the beginning of my inventory, I had to correct the things I had done wrong. It wasn't about saying "I'm sorry." It was about mending the relationship. And that was to be the beginning of a lifelong process. Saying "I'm sorry" doesn't cut it. It's making it right. As a result of not being allowed to do things other than the way the book said it, things happened. The relationship with my mom. Mom died in 1999. Mom died after a long bout with diabetes. You know, they start cutting at the toes and wound up with nothing left. And she died in 1999. I remember I'd been up to see her many times during this long illness, and we developed this close love and close relationship. And I really didn't know how much healing there had been done until the last call I got. Would I come up and see her, that it was the very end. And I remember flying up there and going into the hospital, and she's in this hospital, and I walk into the room, and there's nurses and doctors in there, and my sisters are in there, and my kid brother's in there, because that child was born a boy. He's 18 years younger than me, but they were all in there, and she's in there. The room lit up like there was a searchlight in there with a smile on her face. And as she lit up like that, the nurse looked at her and said, "Rita," that was my mother, and said, "Rita, that must be your son you're telling us about." And she said, "Yeah." She said, "That's my son, Jay." She said, "And I love him so much. And you know, he's the best son a mother could ever ask for. You gave me that by telling me to repair the damage I had done." My dad? Well, I'll tell you about Vaughn first, my wife. Vaughn had a stroke in 1994. We had a wonderful marriage. Good times, bad times, times we wanted to kill each other, divorce each other. Normal marriage, you know, just good. And I learned how to be a good husband. And I learned how to be a faithful husband. My wife had a stroke in 1994. Between 1994 and 2000, she had 11 more strokes. She had a radical mastectomy in 1997. She died of renal failure on July 12th, the year 2000, in my arms. We had not called hospice in until 12 hours before she died, because she was trying to stay alive to go to Mexico that Saturday for our son's wedding. And we saw she couldn't make it. I had to do what was talked about earlier. I had to tell her that it was okay if she went. It was okay if she died. And I didn't want her to die, because I had truly learned how to love her. I remember holding her in my arms as she breathed her last. And people say death is beautiful. It's not always beautiful. It was a terrible, ugly thing to see that night. Because when she died in rictus. That's that thing where you get all contorted and your face gets... She died at 2 o'clock in the morning, but I'll never forget the words she said to me before she died. She said, "Thank you for being my husband, and I love you." She used to tell the girls that went to Al-Anon group, some of the guys from my area are here today, and they knew her, and she'd tell the girls in the Al-Anon group, She was afraid of dying, but she was afraid of what me. She didn't want me to be alone. She had a love that was unbelievable and a love of a God that you will never, that I will never comprehend. I say that I love my God. Let me tell you, that night that she died, I'm cleaning out the bedroom before she died because people were coming and going and I didn't want souvenirs to disappear, you know, mementos. And I'm calling the hospices there. You know, they were there that afternoon and I'm moving stuff. There's a little box left on the dresser. And I take this box and I shake it and I figure she got money in it because we all rat hole here and there, you know. I go to prize this little lock off and I feel guilty because I've never looked in her purse in the 35 years of our marriage. She's never looked in my wallet or my dresser. You know, we respected each other. As I start to open this box, I'm feeling guilty, and I open it, and the only thing in it is a little paper. And I found out later that that box was a thing they call a God box. My wife was so afraid of dying. We'd sit at the kitchen table every morning, and I'd get her something to eat and sit before I go off, and she would ask God to help her, and she just stated she was afraid, and she was trying to turn it over. It was just there, this fear. Knew death was coming, knew it for 6 years. And she did all the things she was supposed to. But I opened this box, there was a paper fell out. And as I read the paper, I came apart. The paper said, "Dear God, please help me with your plan for me. Please help me to accept your plan for me and remove this awful fear." Now, that's a powerful prayer, but it was the way she signed it that got me. It was signed, "With all my love, Vaughn." I have never ended a prayer to my God by saying, "With all my love, Jay." As I read that and thought about it, I realized how much she was teaching me. I went over and kissed her, and she was gone. This ain't about sadness. This is about happiness. It's about life. But life is a part of death, and death's a part of life. And you're all going to have stuff that's fun and stuff that ain't fun. But we got to live it. And the thing is that it all can be done sober. And if I do what I'm supposed to do today, whatever happens today is going to be okay, whether it's death or whatever. It's going to be okay if I do what I'm supposed to do today. My dad, he and I never had warm and fuzzies, never. My dad died of cancer in 1981. He died a horrible death. And we were never close. We never had the communication that even you and I have had, me from the podium and you listening. Dad and I just were never on wavelength together. But I tried to do what I was supposed to do as a loving son, and I talked to Brian, a mentor of mine. I talked to Brian, and he'd say, "Be a loving son," and I tried to. He said, "Allow him to die with dignity. Don't interfere." And I tried to do the things I was supposed to. And I never knew if that amend had been made or that relationship was whole. And then I got a card from him on my 7th AA birthday. And a card opened it up. I couldn't read it. It was scribbles on it. This intelligent, literate man could not write now. His hands wouldn't work. All I could see was "Love, Dad," and part of it cut off. And a letter fell out from my mom explaining the letter. He says, "It's important you know what this card was about. Your dad wanted to communicate with you, you know, on your birthday because it was so important to him. He took himself all his pain medications, everything, so his thoughts would be lucid and clear." He said, "And as he tried to write, he couldn't write. He never accepted he was dying. He just thought he was..." She said, "But as he couldn't get it down, he finally looked up at her and he said, 'Rita, I know I'm a sick man and I'll die soon.' At that moment, he accepted his coming death. But she said, 'It's important you know what he was trying to say.'" It was in quotes. It said, "Dear son, congratulations on your AA birthday. What a glorious and wonderful day. And how can we ever be grateful enough to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for all that it's given us? For it's given us a loving God who's returned a lost son and we discovered a lost father." And I carry that with me. That happened many years ago, 20-some years ago. 23 years ago. And I carry that with me, close to me all the time. And when I don't want to do something, when I don't feel like making one of the trips or going somewhere or making that 2 o'clock 12-step call, I think to myself, how can I be grateful enough to this deal we call Alcoholics Anonymous and for all that it's given me? You heard what it's given me. It's given me the ability to be a child of God and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you a way that I can do that. I can remember that these principles, the steps, the traditions, our big book, they were given to us by God. They were given us by God to some men and a woman who wrote it down. And they gave it to others, who gave it to you, who gave it to me. All of us in that chain charged with the same responsibility. That we don't do nothing to change it. nothing to tweak it, nothing to make it better, nothing to improve it, but to leave it just exactly the way it was when we got it. So that there's a place for a drunk to go who's got nowhere else to go. I started by telling you I will never be able to express to you how grateful I am for all that you've given me. Thank you for my God and privilege of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.